Welcome to the Simpleton Podcast, the most popular podcast of good-looking, highly educated, cosmopolitan Catholics. Welcome to being part of this audience. So two of our extraordinary listeners sent us some critical feedback on the podcast. They kind of were going after us on some political stuff. They stopped short of canceling us, but they leveled some interesting arguments, which I think deserve to be addressed, and we're going to address them at the very end of the podcast. But I think what's interesting, kind of on a big picture thing, by the way, welcome, Laura. How are you?
Good, Clark. How are you?
Good. But I think a big picture question that it raises is, why politics at all?
Yeah.
Because I think when Laura and I cover anything that's spiritual or for the Missioner's Manual, there's zero negative feedback, although there probably should be, but there's zero negative feedback. So like, Why do we even venture out into some of the crazy politics of our time? You know?
I think these two pieces of feedback, or at least one of them, said that they really appreciated the spiritual parts of our podcast, and that has been noted.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Catholicism in general and religion and ask, what do you want from your religion? You know, like at the core, like, what is this all about? You know, and I'm going to say that because I want to say, like, where would politics fit into all this? Right. Mm-hmm. The thing I most want from religion is meaning, purpose, and some way of being reconciled and loved, you know, and brought into harmony with God again, you know?
Yeah.
And I think when I think of like the kind of faith, hope, love, I think it's kind of, I'm just rewording that. Like when I think of meaning and purpose, faith and hope are very tied into that, you know? And to me, that's the part of religion that I most yearn for. And that's the part that no matter where I am in the concentration camp or the billionaire or the wherever, it's accessible. You know, it's harder to access sometimes when you're very rich, but it's there for everyone, no matter what your circumstance, politically or personally or materially, you know?
Yeah. I asked myself the question and I thought meaning and freedom, you know, and maybe meaning and freedom are captured in faith, hope, and love. and the freedom is like freedom from myself and freedom from the concentration camp and freedom to love and freedom to, you know, to be happy, and the meaning, why do any of it, you know?
And so I think naturally like 70, 80, 90% of all your spiritual energy, like that's the right work, is working on those things, you know? But I do think there's this other idea of like, given that this is all like one of the aspects of Christianity and Catholicism is that this is deeply true, you know, like we are actually understanding the essence of the universe here. And interpersonal relationships is part of that, not just the interpersonal relationship of a husband and wife or a friend or a parent and child, but also the interpersonal relationship with greater society, with your parish, with all these things, right?
Yeah.
And I think that somehow this religion that claims to be truth also is an interpretive lens for everything else.
Yeah, right? And it has implications on how you're going to act and move through the world and what kind of choices you're going to make.
And historically, the church has been political. And to me, the church becomes political either at the moment that Constantine, the emperor of the Roman Empire, converts, or at the moment where Pope Simplicius, sounds like a listener to the podcast. He's the only Pope Simplicius. I was hoping, we just looked up before this podcast whether or not he had a whole line of Simplicius the second and third.
We have 10 listeners that love our podcast.
There's only one Pope Simplicius. Only one. And he's the dude who, when the Western Roman Empire had completely disintegrated, he stepped up in the void of government and did the negotiations with the barbarians, you know? And that's interesting. It's like when society has failed to govern itself and be politically, you know, have any center, the Pope himself stood in and became the government at that moment and negotiated on behalf of the people, right? And that's at the very beginning of what I like to call the Dark Ages. We have listeners who hate that term, or the early Middle Ages, right? all the way through to the Enlightenment, the church is playing this very active role in politics, right? Mm-hmm. Where the bishops are either literally like raising armies possibly, or just being like a counterbalance to the monarchs, you know? And there's no social doctrine to kind of note that, right? There's no Catholic social doctrine in there in that period. Mm-hmm. And then at the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment is twinned with the Industrial Revolution in a way, during the Enlightenment, we kind of create this secular space for government, and the overt role of bishops and the popes as political leaders goes to the back seat. And I think, like Warren and I, you've talked, and I've talked about, like, secularism as a secular space for government, meaning like a truly non-religious government, I think is good. I think Catholicism can thrive underneath those conditions.
Yeah.
You know, unless, go ahead.
At the time of the Enlightenment, like there may have been a healthy check that the church needed, you know, too much power or corruption or, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah. Us being like overtly political as church could have been a corrupting influence in the church too.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting that like secularism as a space for the church to thrive. We read this interesting book here in Kansas City. This is a worthy read, by the way, because it's just like a primary source document that's interesting. It's about this Irish priest who was raised in Ireland under the persecution in Ireland, experienced, I think, the famine or the beginning of it, and then came to America and became the founder of like kind of these Western Missouri dioceses, mm-hmm. right? And he's just riding around experiencing incredible American anti-Catholicism, like to the point he can't wear the collar because like people have tried to kill him multiple times just for being a priest. And then during the Civil War, he like literally gets excited and grabs a gun and jumps in the trenches with the other soldiers because he's so pro-Union. And we think of that as being anti-slavery, but I think he's actually not just anti-slavery. He's actually pro the whole idea of America, mm-hmm. you know, coming from Ireland, mm-hmm. you know, like he just wants a place where he has a chance to plant a church, convert people, and work even like in a secular environment. Like that's just so much better than where he was coming from, where they were dominated by the English, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that the church can be really cool with secularism and these Enlightenment principles, as long as the secularism doesn't become a rival religion itself, right? Which I think we see now. But it's also something I think that 100 years ago with communism was also, that was like a secular religion, a secularism religion, mm-hmm. you know? So multiple times secularism kind of gets this like religious air to it. And then Catholicism's got a real problem, you know? So as the church is like, in a sense, moving out of politics, after about 100 years in 1890s, Pope Leo jumps in with Rerum Novarum and like gets right back into politics, right? And he's like strongly condemning communism, also condemning like a radical, like laissez-faire libertarian type idea mm-hmm. also, mm-hmm. right? Doing more condemning than he is blessing, meaning like he's not necessarily showing the way as much as he is saying these two things are not the way.
Yeah.
You know, let me tell you right. for sure, right? And that's considered the beginning of the social doctrine of the church. So as the church stepped out of politics, like overtly, it stepped back into politics with this idea of like forming the laity to, that's like our proper sphere in this new structure. Mm-hmm. We don't count on the bishop to be the political leader. We're the political, we're supposed to be formed by the church and then act within the political sphere.
Yeah.
So having said that, if everything was running well, I don't think we would do any politics in our podcast, you know, or very little anyway. I think what's really interesting about this moment in time is probably since about Trump's election in 2016, it's become obvious that we have come to some weird turning point, and it's not clear that the way politics works 10 years from now will be almost unidentifiable to what we are doing right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe not, but there's a good probability of it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that something that we're both like interested in is the populist movements across the West are raising the most interesting problems and questions, and they seem to be very good at that. They seem to be very bad at coming up with the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it also seems like they're also throttled to, you know, I mean, there's some powers that be that seem to like keep them from, you know, enacting solutions also. But I think of like Brexit, where it's like, the people of England went Brexit, and then the political powers that be did everything they did to draw it out and basically make it ineffectual, you know? Anyway, I think that's kind of this interesting point in history we're at. What do you got to say, Laura?
Yeah, I think when we were discussing this earlier, you said, the primary things we want, you know, faith, hope, and love, meaning, et cetera. But that there are secondary other things that, faith, like our faith is giving us, you know, it's like like the lens for understanding. And so, yes, it might be, it's like lower down, right, than the spiritual aspects. But when we were talking about this, I liked that you pointed out that the understanding the way the world works, understanding politics, thinking about politics is something that like our faith helps us with, but it's like a secondary, you know, it is a secondary thing, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be, you know, it's still worth spending our time on.
It almost feels like it's a natural outgrowth of the first.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels to me like it's almost weirdly throttling the religion to not allow it to go there, to not allow your mind and stuff to go there.
Yeah. I really like doing like the content on our podcast, of like the manual and some of the insights we've gained from our ministry. And I think one thing that came up in the critiques was that they appreciated that we weren't trying to be conservative or liberal Catholics. And I think that's right. We're not trying to like be kind of like party Catholics. It is very difficult, I think, if you're talking about the world and your faith to stay apolitical, and to the point that it makes me, I'm not sure it makes sense, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think the interesting attitude to me is like, if you're going to become apolitical, like you view the kingdom of God as a truly separate kingdom from the rest of the kingdoms, you know? And then you're like building something that is just like unrelated to everything else society's concerned with in a way.
Yeah.
Kind of, I think the Amish are a good example of this. Like they're very successful. By the way, the Amish are being very successful. They're growing in leaps and bounds, you know? Yeah. But I think that really the leaven is what we are, you know, like this kingdom of God is like almost this like secret yet not secret. It's like the light on the hill, but it's like this like thing that permeates, and we need our Catholic generals. We need our Catholic politicians, we need our Catholic social workers, you know, permeating all these structures and aligning it with the kingdom of God, you know?
And I think like,
and it's
like
messy work.
It's messy work. Messy work. One of my, top favorite podcasts that I listen to regularly is a CFR podcast. And that is almost exclusively like spiritual subjects, or they'll go through a Jacques Philippe book, or, you know, they'll develop some of their own themes they want to talk about in a series, or, and I like their podcast. I like the format of their podcast. There's also something right about that, because that is like their primary concern, you know, in life. And it's like, well, our primary concern is like getting to heaven. Like, we're also trying to figure out how to be parents in this world, how to have a business in this world, how to, you know, all of it, you know.
I think our concern, you could almost divide it where it's like priests and religious, particularly priests in the church officially, is most in charge of the temple, the parish itself, right? And then the laity's job is like everything else, right? This is why I kind of question whether or not parish schools should exist, because I say that meaning like I think Catholic schools should exist. I just don't know that they should actually be parish schools, because I think I don't know that that's within the priest's core competency to run in the school, right? Meaning like the laity are being entrusted with the education, the military, the politics, the city government, the
people being able to have their livelihoods,
literally,
you know,
roofing houses and sheltering people. Yeah. Right. And your job as a lay person is first and foremost to get yourself and your family through this crazy world, and secondarily to shape that world.
Yeah.
Right. Which is inherently just political, you know?
Yeah.
I want to throw out something that's just kind of an interesting way that Catholicism and politics gets weird. So there's this organization that I've known of for over 20 years called the U.S., USCMA, United States Catholic Mission Association.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when Simple House was starting, part of where this manual comes from is this idea of like, hey, we need to be real missionaries. How do you do it? right? Mm-hmm. And there was this incredible apologetics literature, which, if anything's overdone, like, it's, yeah. it's like, yeah. you're now answering objections that you never have in real life. You're just like, they're just love answering objections,
yeah.
you know, but if anything, this apologetics thing is super well defined, but then it's like, but that doesn't really seem like missionary,
yeah.
you know? So, and I discovered somehow early on that there was a term called missiology, which means the study of mission work. And then there was a U.S. CMA, and I thought, well, excellent, right? Finally, someone who's actually thinking critically about evangelization, right? And in my own naive mind, what I thought was probably going on here was the old Jesuits, the St. Francis Xaviers, the different people, like, had to be writing about effective mission work, mm-hmm. right? I would just think there's, like, stuff to be learned from these guys, right? And there's got to be someone who's like an academic who's combed through that and come up with like best practices or strategies or mm-hmm. just a discussion of these things, right? And that this would be very valuable, right? Yeah. This would be what missiology in my mind would have been, right? So I started on this search to find missiology stuff and couldn't find squat, you know, and maybe it's out there, but I just couldn't get anything of quality, you know? And then I tried to call the US CMA 20 years ago and never got my calls returned. I think I called, tried a couple of times. At that point, my instinct is it was headquartered in DC, maybe at Trinity College or something like that. Mm-hmm. But so it was clear they wanted nothing to do with my little urban mission. You know, like, it's just like, they don't answer my phone calls.
Yeah.
I'm not important enough for this. And I can't get access to any relevant materials. So I'm just as, even though I got really excited that these things might exist, I just have not been able to find real things, yeah. right? 20 years later, I get invited to sit in on a meeting of the U.S., of a committee meeting of the U.S. Catholic Mission Association, mm. right? And during the meeting, I realized that the project they're working on is so different than the project I'm working on that it doesn't make sense for them to have me a part of it or me to be part of it, you know, on either side, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I need to be part of it, I need to about face the organization onto a new track, which I don't know why they want to do that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know why they want to like accommodate me on this because I'm kind of like, don't find value in their projects, you know? And their projects are all along the lines of like, how do we help the different Catholic missions be more aware of greenhouse gases? Or how do we help them with intersectionality? Or how do we help them like build bridges in certain ways, right? Mm-hmm. And they're actually questing for these projects to like offer formation to mission leaders in these like, what I think
like
most
side
people,
agendas. Yeah.
yeah. Most people I'd say well, these are political issues almost, right? They're almost only in the social doctrine is what it felt like. And I knew that if you took the random 20 something, mm-hmm. that's part of like all these new mission organizations like Bruce City Missionaries, Source of All Hope, Simple mm-hmm. House, Focus, Net, whatever. Like these are major mission organizations mm-hmm. and they're not really being represented in this U.S. Catholic Mission Association, right? Nor should they be because they don't really care about what the U.S. CMA is focusing on and the U.S. CMA. In order to focus on what these people care about would probably have to rebirth itself in a way that why would you like if yeah. you've got a clientele that likes what you're doing, like an older mission group that is actually an audience for you. Why would you rebirth? You know? So I thought that was just really interesting because I knew that if I brought like a 20 something in, I said, look, we're going to go into a mission association meeting mm-hmm. and we're never going to talk about evangelization.
Yeah.
They'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Now, having been someone who's from the 90s, who's been through stupid church stuff for so long, it wasn't that surprising to me that that's the way that thing ran.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that kind of interesting? So there's this way that politics can just take over.
Oh, that's bad. You're saying
that's bad, right?
Yeah.
And it reminds mm-hmm. me of this thing where there was this guy became the Bishop of Dallas, I think, but he was an associate auxiliary bishop in D.C. and D.C. was going to build a building for evangelization. Mm-hmm. It was going to like have a little dedicated like building that for, yeah. you know, evangelization in the diocese. And in order to justify it, one of the proposals was, well, how about we let Catholic Charities rent one floor and the evangelization will be on the mm-hmm. other floor. And the auxiliary bishop was like, no, if you put charity workers on one floor, they're going to take over the whole building until you're in a closet. And it's true somehow. Like, somehow that type of work pushes out the spiritual work, the more overtly spiritual work.
I mean, I think we have had that in our own organization, right? It's like we're trying always to put boundaries around, you know, like the grocery deliveries can feel really urgent more than the Bible studies and, you know, keeping.
That's right. It's always like a check and balance with us. And you always have to check against the charitable political stuff towards the evangelization stuff.
You have to check the material.
Yes.
And we believe in material help, but it's like easy for the material help to take over and dominate. And
right. Yeah. I think that's actually one of the special things about Simple House is that we are going to keep the material help, even though it does, in a sense, always threaten the spiritual work.
Yeah. You know, like, I feel like it's pretty common that every year we need a reorientation and we do it over and over again and it's good.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's also true of our podcast. You know, we want to have a reorientation to keep us spiritual, but we're not ignoring the material.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do appreciate the feedback.
I do too. And we'll talk about the specific feedback here in a minute. So don't think you're being ignored. We also have a great solution to this problem that turns it back on our criticizers.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. All right. I want to talk about three biases I think Americans have that are probably most people in the audience have at least two of these three biases at some level.
Yeah.
Okay. These are all kind of middle class America biases. Catholics have them a little bit worse than most in a lot of ways. So, all right. Ready for the first bias. American exceptionalism. So when you say American exceptionalism, that term's been kind of popular for a while. It kind of means that America has a special place in the world, or that if you define what a nation is, to make that definition fit all the nations of the world and the U.S., you'd need like a little asterisk to say, and there's this nation, the U.S., that has to police the world or to provide these services or, you know, do X, Y, Z, right? And it also is kind of American exceptionalism. It's like, if I say this thing happened in the U.S. that's shady, you might assume the best, but if that exact same thing happened in a country that wasn't named France, England, or the U.S., you would assume the worst, you know?
Yeah, that would be I was thinking that when you were talking about this, it came to mind like, well, no, like some people like hate America. And I was thinking about like late 90s, early 2000s, like the ugly American, you know? But there's something that's like, how dare the American person be tacky in a foreign country? Like they should know better, but you can forgive another person for being a little tacky in a foreign country.
True. And you know, the ugly American thing's actually from like the 50s.
Oh, that's from the 50s.
There's a movie called The Ugly American.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
I think it's black and white even. So it's been around a minute, you know?
Is it a good movie?
I don't know. The concept's good, but
yeah. Yeah. The criticism of the ugly, like don't be entitled and rude is a thing, a message a lot of people need. So I don't want to totally trash the,
Sure. It's good. It's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea of American exceptionalism is not without foundation, right? Like we're kind of the country that seems to have gotten secularism right for most of our history. It's been hard fought, but we kind of done a pretty good job. We're kind of the hero of World War I, more so just because of the resources we provided than because of some heroic thing we did besides that, you know? And then we're also the hero of World War II. You know, also mostly because of logistical reasons, not because of the specific war was definitely us as the primary mover, you know, but the death rate of Americans is nothing compared to the death rates of all these other people, particularly the Russians.
Yep.
You know, the sacrifice the Russians made in World War II is unbelievable. Yeah. You know, it's like 40% of their army. Our death rate in our army was like 2% or less.
I mean,
you know?
Just a great number of their people and their cities were destroyed.
Right. But America was key in these things, despite this, partly because of the logistical things we provide, you know? So at the end of World War II, it's clear that America's riding high. It's riding high in world prestige. It's riding high in its own competency, being well-run, right? And so people had a very high opinion of the U.S., both Americans and outsiders. Like one of the things that clued me into American exceptionalism was in the late 90s, I had a German roommate, and he said, he was a little bit older than me. He would have been almost 30. He goes, he's a professor now in the US, but he goes, America is the natural born leader of the world and it should be, you know? And it was like a non-American just saying, America needs to lead, let's go, you know?
Yeah.
And so America's riding really high after World War II. We are kind of the natural born leader of the world. And we're doing things like what the Roman Empire would do. Like the way the Roman Empire made peace across the world by securing the roads and creating the road network.
We keep the seas.
Yeah. We did the seas. By the way, this is a little bit of an aside, but Ben, if you can figure out how to clip out this part of the life of Brian where they're critiquing the Roman Empire.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system, and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
Okay, well, the point of that was, in the Roman Empire, you could complain about empires and colonialization and all these things, but there were other good things. There's a reason why it lasted for centuries was because of the good things it was providing, you know, like security and aqueducts and things like this. So the America was kind of this natural born leader. America was very high on itself. America thought it could do things. And then we went into Vietnam. And then we also had this falling apart at home. We had like race riots. We had the sexual revolution. We had multiple assassinations of our people. And we have this completely stupid Vietnam War, you know, that destroys a generation and also just doesn't win. It's just a complete suck, you know, of resources and energy and of our competence. You know, no competent people join an organization that does things like the Vietnam War. And that's what we're seeing right now in our own government is like, we don't even have a GED requirement for the military anymore because you can't get competent people to join the military right now. Because we've just watched the military lose every war and do no good, you know? And so patriotic Americans who are born in the Midwest, who've been to the core of the military for a long time, aren't joining, you know? So you're getting a much less competent group come in. But so there's this destruction of the Vietnam War, but then we get another shot in the arm in 89 when the Berlin Wall falls, because the U.S. had essentially been subsidizing the whole defense of what then was called the free world. So the free world, for our young listeners, was that world which was not aligned with the Soviet bloc, you know, and we were overwhelmingly responsible for protecting that world, right? Yeah. Germany could not pay to defend Germany. England could not pay to, and France could not pay to defend themselves because partly because they were rebuilding after being destroyed in World War II and partly because the US's wealth is legend. You know, and that's why so many American foreign military bases were there holding the line in Europe, you know, and also internationally, like we secured the seas.
Yeah.
So then now we're riding high after we win the Cold War. And now we're at this great crisis again. We've had forever. We've shown that we no longer know how to rebuild a nation. We no longer can have this miracle of Germany and Japan's rebuilding. We went in to fight Islamic fundamentalism. Terrorists, and
we created
we are pockets. The main cause now of it, you know. I mean, like we slaughtered inadvertently the minorities in these countries, particularly Iraq. You know, like the Yazidi genocide that happened about 10 years ago was because we took out the people who were keeping that from happening for the last century. We took them out, and then ISIS and things like that are born. And anyway, so we have just been making a mess of things for 20 years, right?
I mean, longer, go ahead. But yeah.
Well, I'm not that down. I mean, but I know that the wars we started after 9/11 are a disaster. Yeah.
It seems like our Latin American record was kind of kept more under wraps.
right. Well, yeah. Also, it's really hard to judge like on this enormous net scale of good. And, like, saying, was the Roman Empire good or bad from zero to the year 400? I don't know, you know, but it's really hard to judge. But this idea of American exceptionalism, I think, is this idea that our competence is still there. Our moral authority is there. It would be better if we, you know, if our diplomats had their way in these countries and the people they supported became the rulers of these countries.
Yeah.
We have the solution somewhere and we have the ability to affect it, you know, which to me, is completely anti the magic of America, right? Meaning, like, if you were to look at our Constitution and say, what are the things that made us great? Everything you mention, separation of powers, checks mm-hmm. and balances, freedom of speech, right to bear arms, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, all of these things are because we actually don't trust power. And this American exceptionalism is like a trust of power.
Mm.
So to me, like, the things that make power trustworthy is lots of skepticism.
Yeah.
But I do think this is just a bias we have in general. Like, if you're always on the hunt for corruption, you'll have a place that's not very corrupt. If you start believing you're not corrupt, you'll have corruption.
Yeah, I think when you say that, it's like, I think there's like a healthy amount of skepticism, right? But it's like, you know, people that are think everything is corrupt and are unwell, you know? So,
right. Yeah. There's doomers of all.
Yeah.
During the best of times, you still have doomers. Yeah.
I think a healthy person would understand that there's a human element to a lot of things, and understanding the motivations and the things that make people tick, and not assuming that our government is acting always out of benevolence and
incompetence, even, like, the idea, like, do you trust the USDA to protect the food or not? Do you trust the FDA to protect the drugs, you know, and mm-hmm. to do that well? I don't know that trust is a good thing. You know, maybe these organizations need shaken up every decade. I'm not sure. But
yeah.
But like, to let it kind of go as a, hey, they're professionals, trust them, is not, I think, is kind of against what made America great.
Yeah.
All right. Having said all that, I mean, there is a case to be made that the U.S. is one of the most competent countries in the world and has done a fair amount of good. But I think, to me, like, by calling it a bias, I'm saying that there's a good number of people who have an unrealistically high evaluation of that, and it's distorting their reasoning. Now, you also have an American exceptionalist if you think we're the worst thing that ever happened.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the second bias. So the second bias, I like to call, like, evil is a four-letter word. And what I mean by that is, like, evil is like a cuss word that you're not supposed to use.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let me give an example of something that I would not be afraid to call evil at this point. I think most nonprofits have really screwed up incentive structures. I think a lot of them, the main incentive of the nonprofit is make sure you don't go down a ball of flames and scandal, and two, protect your job and create a good, you know, job for you and your buddies who work at the nonprofit. Those are the two primary motivators.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing a nonprofit to, like, feed people, and those are your two motivators, then for the sake of, you're basically telling people that they're giving money to feed people, but you're actually giving it to yourself and your buddies who run the thing. You're taking food out of the mouths of the poor. You know, I call mm-hmm. that evil, you know, and I don't call that, like, oh, you know, mismanagement, or, you know, oh, maybe it needs reformed a little bit. Now I call that evil, you know?
Yeah.
And when I say evil is a four-letter word, is I think we're afraid to call things evil. And we're also afraid to really look at overt evil, like the kids who shoot up a school and then kill themselves, or hit, you know, these, like to think that that's real, that there are just people walking around who want to burn everything down and hurt society and themselves.
Yeah.
These people, I believe, exist, and we have this bias against believing they exist, you know?
Yeah. Going back to Plato, like, he thought that a person would not, you know, I hope I'm formulating this correctly, you know, a person would reject the good or not do the good out of ignorance. But if the person, like, truly knew the good, that they would choose the good, you know. But so ignorance of the good was the reason why someone, and I think that we have, like, we want to think like that, kind of to give people credit. And I do think that that can be a useful idea in your spiritual life, or understanding what's motivating other people. But then there are things that it's like, you can't make sense out of them that way. And I, like, the example that came to my mind is, like, there's like a kind of these little groups of sadistic internet trolls that like find the victim and make them do all these horrible things to themselves, you know, and film it and watch it and send it to other people. And that's like trying to find like the misplaced good there is like a weird exercise, you know?
Yeah. So,
or the misunderstood good, you know?
Yeah. If this philosophical theological idea that there is no evil, there's just misplaced good is true, then it's so nuanced that it allows for Hitler, you know, and it allows for the Columbine shooters, and it allows for people who just want to hurt people. And so if that's true, then it's not a great cash value statement, meaning like it's not a statement. It's almost more cash value to just say, hey, there's evil people in the world. Beware, you know, as opposed to, hey, there's not evil people. There's just people with misplaced good, you know?
Yeah.
And it is true, though, that like in most negotiations, in most conflicts, if you just kind of ask, sit back for a second, say, what do they really need? Let's talk to them about what they are really looking for here. Yeah. And then what we're really looking for, and see if there's some peaceful thing where they're not being evil and we're not being evil, but we're just going to come up with a win-win here. Right.
Yeah.
That's real. That has been, there's probably been periods in history where that was not well understood and not emphasized enough. But I think we're in the reverse situation now, to the point that we allow predators to operate because we are too generous in the way that, because we think evil is so non-existent in a way.
Yeah.
Let's move on from evil as a four-letter word, because partly what these three biases do is they work together to create a problem. And I want to get to the last bias. Mm-hmm. So the last bias is this idea of the black swan. So a black swan event is a catastrophic event that happens in history, and all the future generations look at the previous generations and say, you should have saw it coming.
Yeah.
And so it's somehow a catastrophic event, and they didn't see it coming. It's a catastrophic event that people systematically underestimate the probability of, right?
Like the Capris would come back in style. Yeah.
Worse than that. Okay. I don't think the Great Recession counts. I don't think a lot of these things count, but let me just throw out a few that would count. Like the Great Depression, World War II, any future nuclear war, any future major famine or plague, not like a pandemic like we had, but like a real plague, an asteroid, a volcano event that disrupted growing seasons, which has happened three times in the last 2,000 years. I mean, just things like this would be absolutely catastrophic. Anything where the U.S. got in a war with China or got in a war with, I don't know, a bigger war than we are now, you know, all these things would be, or a civil war. That's a good example, right? Even if the probability of these events is quite low, like say like the probability of this, one of these bad things happening is only 0.1%, right? Next year. That means it's 1% over 10 years. You know, so the probability of this happening in the next decade starts getting bigger and bigger. And what's interesting about the black swan issue and the evils of four-letter word issue and the American exceptionalism issue is that when you have these biases, you actually don't work to prevent these things. Meaning like if you...
I think you could say like, you know, to a smaller degree, like the church scandals, like, came, you know, everyone thought that the priests in the church were good and always acting in everybody's interest, you know, and there was things that looked weird, but people weren't calling it out.
I would say that's the evils of four-letter word problem, like within the church in a way. And it's kind of like the mafia was like this, too. Like the mafia up until the 80s had this very deliberate policy of not admitting they existed.
Yeah.
So if you were like in the Italian ghetto, you knew for a fact it existed, but like they would never say anything that it existed until like the 80s. They found out like, we got to give it up. We actually have to admit we exist, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But they get, but not existing is an enormous advantage for the mafia.
Right, right.
Right.
But I think it's not just evil as a four letter word, because in the church we were doing nothing to prevent sexual abuse. And now we're like, oh, of course, if you prevent it. Now looking back, we're like, oh, if you create an institutional thing that protects abuse and allows, you know, people to be, you know, alone with children in a vulnerable place, abuse is going to happen. Like, we know that now.
Right. Yeah. So it's both a black swan. It was a completely predictable problem.
I'm saying it's all three of these things, though. It's all three of these biases. Right. Yeah.
So, like, you're allowing evil people. If you don't suspect evil, you allow evil people to operate. Mm-hmm. If you don't suspect a black swan event, you don't prepare for it, and you don't buy insurance, and you don't prevent it. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's a lot of things you can do to make a black swan event not as bad, but you're not going to do it if you don't. If you systematically underestimate the probability. Mm-hmm. And same with American exceptionalism, it's just one of those things that says it's not going to happen here or something like that, right? Yeah. So all of these things, I think, make a moment of transition in America, I don't know, like more dangerous or more likely to gobsmack you, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm worried about. It can't be that becoming a doomer is the answer. But trying to get a realistic read on it is a real piece of work, and you're going to have to fight some biases.
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do on this podcast is have our eyes open, but still maintain like a hopeful, happy view of the future, you know, and like we're in God's hands and it's okay, you know.
I feel like knowing God's got us is realistic hope. It's realistic, it's theological, it's everything. Yeah. Thinking that everything will be hunky-dory is not necessarily realistic or true, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to say that. Yeah.
Right. I was just throwing that out there.
Oh, yeah. Because,
like,
yeah,
hope
could
be its own bias if it's taken unrealistically. If it's, like, hope in a nice, comfortable future, that could be unrealistic.
Yeah.
Hope in God is not unrealistic at all.
Right. You know? Right. The doomer, a lot of times, is missing kind of a bigger hope. Right.
The doomer has his own bias, you know, and it's often a bias of self-importance too. Like, I just watched the movie Tremors. This is a great movie from the 90s, everybody. It's free on YouTube last time I looked. So it's good family movie night. It's about this small town that gets attacked by worms. But anyway, one of the few, like, there's only like 10 residents in this town and they know each other really well, you know. One of the few residents is like the prepper, right?
Uh-huh.
And they have like 5 years of food and all this stuff, you know, and they're living in this thing. And when finally the apocalyptic moment of their life arrives, the attack, right? They're pissed because it's not what they prepared for. And they were kind of secretly hoping that the doom that they prepared for would happen. It'd be like validating.
Yeah.
So it's like, Yeah. Look, we told you so, you know, but instead it's just funny to watch them get pissed that it's not the doom that they wanted. But, all right, let's move on. All right. I think a future episode, there's two civilization really changing things that are happening that I think are a little bit more real than probably most of you guys give them credit for. So we're going to cover them, but we're going to cover them in a future episode. We're going to talk about Neuralink and we're going to talk about SpaceX trying to get to Mars.
Yeah.
But let's skip that for now and go directly to these critiques. Are you ready, Laura?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to introduce these critiques or do you want me to go for it?
Two friends and listeners of our podcast sent us critiques about our Boeing episode. And briefly, one of them mentioned that it was Holy Thursday and we didn't make any mention of Holy Thursday. And I think that in our podcast, we have not always anticipated what day it's coming out when we record it. It was recorded before Holy Thursday. It was not recorded on Holy Thursday. And I thank you for that. And I do think it would just, you know, there's times when we could anticipate that a little bit better. But I think fundamentally the two critiques, one of these listeners said that they listened to our Boeing podcast and felt, you know, pretty like upset about it. And when they went back and tried to research the story on their own, this person felt that the facts that she was seeing did not match the tone of alarm that we had or the alarm that we were raising. So sorry about that. Yeah.
Let's recap the Boeing podcast, case you didn't listen. So we tracked Boeing and we came up with like four problems, right? One is that antitrust has not been enforced since 1982, basically.
Yeah.
And Boeing has been allowed to flaunt this, and that's part of the cause. We also said that there was this expose done by Al Jazeera against the 787. It's really weird that a foreign journalism group, when a domestic journalist have every opportunity to break this story before Al Jazeera, we have all the advantages to break the story. We didn't, but instead a foreign journalist did an hour expose about quality problems on the 787. Yeah. Then we talked about DEI being an attack on meritocracy being a problem, and I think crime in some ways. And that was objected to. We got a criticism of that, that the, I think the criticism's thrust is that's not real life. You basically do need laws and do need these rules to force in integration.
Yeah.
And it's not really attack on meritocracy. I completely disagree with that, but we'll disagree to disagree. If we have this person on,
yeah,
we'll go into that. But then the fourth thing was what you're bringing up, that there was other information that the family of John Barnett, the man who died under suspicious circumstances.
Yeah. Go ahead. The thing that spurred the Boeing episode was that a person who was in the middle of a deposition against Boeing was found dead and looked like or seemed like it could have been a suicide. And that seemed...
You're right. It looked like it seemed like it should have been a suicide at the time that we made this observation.
Yeah. And so we were... alarmed by this. And
I think that it's beyond this. Like, I'm saying that the reason why we covered Boeing wasn't because this guy ended up dead during his deposition. The reason we covered Boeing is it's an interesting case study over decades of a flaw in our system. It's a flaw at the antitrust level. It's a fraud. And the thing I forgot to mention was the issues about 5 years ago of regulatory capture, where Boeing planes are nosediving on autopilot and the US FAA does not ban the flight of them. Every other FAA across the world does, but we don't, right?
Yeah.
And then there's this new problem of doors flying off brand new Boeing planes, and then this guy dies in the deposition. So to me, this is an interesting case study of corrupt capitalism, mm-hmm. completely corrupt. And the cherry on top, and that's, I hate to call it the cherry, but like the thing that's just completely beyond the pale, the thing that makes you go normal corruption to like wide-eyed alarm is this man's death, right? And it should have caused wide-eyed alarm until the family came out and said that they think it's suicide.
Well, they weren't convinced one way or the other because he kind of had a history of mental health problems,
right.
And he had been kind of grinding this axe against Boeing for a long time, and it was had kind of taken over his life for many years.
I agree. Yeah.
And so, yes. So we did not cover that part of the story.
We did not. Not on purpose, but we just didn't get there. And the reason why we didn't get there was clearly this is a developing story because there's even a new whistleblower that's been making the news. And it was a developing story, and when we kind of got all our facts, those facts weren't there. So at the point when we got our facts, the only facts we heard was the lawyers didn't think it was suicide and his friends didn't think it was suicide. Yeah. And Boeing had lost approximately $50 billion of market cap.
Yeah.
Right? Due to these problems. And not to mention all their subs, which may not even remain in business due to this. So the amount of economic turmoil surrounding this is so enormous, you know, that like there's a lot of motivation to shut this thing down, right? So there's like, there's a motive. The people closest thought it was not suicide. And then we quit our investigation right there.
Yeah, and then I don't want to like dig in too much into this, really. I think you said it best when you said, it was a developing story, is a developing story. We covered it as a developed story.
What do you mean by you don't want to dig into it?
The circumstances of his death are shady. They are worrisome. I think it's right to identify that it does not look good and wonder about the implications of that to some extent. It's not like a...
I think skepticism's warranted.
I think, yeah, but I guess the reason I don't want, I think there's like a lot of agree to disagree here in how you see it. I don't know.
I would say that at the day we filmed, when I didn't know about the family statements, I was like 90-10, meaning like it could have been suicide. If it just
like 10%.
Yeah, 10% chance. Yeah. But like given no one around him thought it was, and given the incredible motivation of billions and billions around it, didn't look like suicide to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just say that didn't pass the smell test. You know, now that the family's come out, I'm probably 60-40, probably suicide, 40%, maybe not, you know, It certainly took my alarm level down. Like, to have a listener say, respected listener, say, I was really alarmed at the end of the episode. I'm like, heck yeah, I was really alarmed at the end of the episode. That's kind of why we did it. But someone could have weighed it differently. You know, yeah. Like someone could have weighed it 80-20, 70-30, 50-50, whatever. I would be a little bit worried about anyone who took it at face value that it wasn't a crime. Mm-hmm. You know, until the family stuff came out. And then if you really do want to just disregard it, I think you can, you know. Having said that, there's still this horrible history. There's like four other problems going on
with this
episode, you know, or with Boeing, including regulatory capture and corruption in the government's regulation agencies, you know. So I don't know. Like, I actually think if I hung out with the listener, we wouldn't be that far off.
Yeah, I think you would come to some agreements and come to some disagreements.
Laura has hung out with the listener, by the way.
Yes. And I appreciate both of these listeners and take their criticism very seriously, because I really respect them as thinkers. And
I took it very seriously, too. That was a very serious. That's partly why we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that I'm just not looking to lose any friends over a podcast, you know. And the podcast I was worried about wasn't the Boeing one. I've been most worried about this dumb one we took down on Israel, Palestine.
Yeah. So we've taken down two podcasts.
So we took down the Boeing one because of this new information. We took down Israel, Palestine. And the Israel, Palestine one, the reason why we took that down is Israel's now attacked Lebanon. It's attacked Syria. It's bombed Gaza to the Stone Age. And it's just kind of like, this isn't okay, you know. We're now flaunting war with Iran, which has powerful allies also, you know. And I do think my main concern there, which is frankly my main concern right now, is that we'll have a major war come out of this little conflict. Mm-hmm. But what's the point of all that? I regret things that were said there too.
Yeah.
All right. So two more things that were mentioned was talking about America as the empire. I actually think if you listen to everything I said about American exceptionalism, anything I wanted to say in response to that was said in that. So whatever. Mm-hmm. It's either, I do think that history might look on this as an American century that was run as if it were a soft power empire, but whatever. But then the other critique that I thought was interesting was when we talked about immigration, we have evidence, there's investigative journalistic evidence that the way the U.S. is shipping around the immigrant kids who are coming over without parents or have no, they don't know who the parents are, is on planes in the middle of the night out of, you know, commercial airports.
Mm-hmm.
This is an established fact. The thing is, no one knows why.
Yeah.
You know, and it could be just that's when the planes are available. It's just so sketch that they won't answer questions about it. And then if somebody wants to go to the deepest, darkest place, okay. Or not. I don't know. I just think you can't have your government doing sketchy stuff and not answering questions. It'd be like if the Catholic Church was shipping around planes full of kids and not answering questions.
Yeah.
They would deserve severe accusation, even if I thought it was improbably true, you know?
So, yeah. But you're saying it's documented. It's not a suspicion. Like it's a point of fact that we're doing this, that we're,
I saw enough people who said they'd seen it and were doing uploading YouTube videos on it.
Yeah.
And we definitely know it's happening with adults too.
Yeah.
Adults are flying without, you know, IDs, but they're kind of being put on normal passenger jets. The fact that they're putting the kids, I mean, it kind of logically makes sense to me, right? That we know how many hundreds of thousands of kids have come over, right? Given that, they do have to transport them, and you can't just throw some 7-year-old next to some 40-year-old business traveler on Delta, you know?
Right.
So it makes sense to me that they are
like doing special
flights, you know?
Yeah.
The thing is if you have a government that's not willing to, and this is across the immigration spectrum, the nonprofits who help the government don't answer questions, they're not willing to give interviews. If you create non-transparency when you're doing something that looks sketchy, what, like, it's very dark.
Yeah.
It's like the framers of the Constitution didn't want us to trust the government.
Yeah.
And then all these biases are against trusting the government. I don't think we should trust them. That doesn't mean they're doing some horrible conspiracy, but operating non-transparently is unexcusable.
Yeah.
Is my opinion, but
yeah.
So anyway, that's just my opinion. And I do think it's worth putting out that out loud in response to that criticism.
Yeah.
I would love to have more help on this. So we're going to invite both of the listeners who gave us this feedback, these critical feedback, to come on a political episode, particularly if we feel like we're going to get into some hairy subject. And we'll just invite them on as co-hosts.
Both of these people have very valuable insight, and it would be great and a pleasure and to have them on.
They're both intelligent, bright people who are good Catholics who, you know, would be their input would be, you know, helpful. Yes. Like, subscribe, pod, whatever. Give us feedback. Obviously, we take feedback seriously. So talk to you later.
Yeah. All right. See you, Clark.
Peace out. Bye.
Bye.